Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We're talking about Big Chicken. It's a new book by today's guest, Maren McKenna. She's an investigative reporter with lots of insights on how our current food raising and agricultural practices have spawned an epidemic of antibiotic resistance. And there's more to the story about Big Chicken. And we're going to share with you some solutions, some practical suggestions. Maren, what about, have chickens changed, not just in terms of the use of antibiotics, they're bigger, but they've been bred to be different. They're a very different kind of bird than they were, say, pre-World War II.
That's right. We talked when we first began discussing chicken about how our grandparents would have had chickens out the back door, and those chickens would have looked very different to the modern broilers that are the basis of most of industrial chicken today. They would have been kind of slender and upright and active. They would have been able to
fly.
Around.
They had wings. Fit. They could,
And
they would peck around in the barnyard. They were, they were active.
Right. They would find their own food. They would feed themselves. I mean, they would get feed. They would get meal, but they also would, scratch up grubs and insects and things like that.
Yep.
So a modern broiler is inevitably white. They are quite round. They have an overabundance of breast muscle because that's what we like to eat in the United States is the white meat, which is the breast and the tenders under it. And relatively speaking, their legs have not kept up. They are bred to be docile because there's no point in having them be feisty and run around a lot. And they have had bred into them an insatiable appetite that that keeps them eating and eating and eating such that they grow to slaughter weight in an average American chicken in about 42 days.
And this is a deliberate product because it's called the chicken of tomorrow. It sounds like something from the World's Fair in 1963, the chicken of tomorrow.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. So I think of it as like something out of the Jetsons. I just kind of hear
right.
Like science fiction music in the back of my head when I say it.
Yeah.
So the problem with chicken was that in several, there's several points in the story of chicken that are really interesting. Because there are points at which demand and supply really get out of whack. So there's a moment when we start to produce more chicken because of growth promoters, because of starting to put them in crowded barns and so forth. But the chickens are still not very delicious. They are still descended from the birds that were mostly intended to be egg layers. And so there's a contest that is sponsored by the USDA with the assistance of the A&P supermarkets. And the goal of this contest at the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s is to remake chicken. They talk about wanting a chicken with a breast you can slice like a steak. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to make the chicken just more like what we have today, which is a chicken that is very meaty. And over the use of antibiotics and the reshaping of genetics through hybridizing these chickens into the chickens of tomorrow and the precision nutrition that follows along after, we now get chickens twice the size in half the time as in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. And Mark Schatzker is the name of a guest we interviewed a couple of years ago. He wrote a book called The Dorito Effect, and the subtitle is The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor. And it's his contention that we've taken things like tomatoes and we've given them longer shelf life and more sex appeal. They look more round and red and, less blemished. But we've lost taste. And to some extent, real aficionados will say the same thing has happened to chicken. There are people who, like you, apparently you've spent some time in Europe. You've enjoyed some of the breeds of chicken that they have there, where they really prize flavor over weight and, other characteristics. And they're better. They're more flavorful.
That's right. And so, all these rolling innovations that together brought us the modern broiler that we have today, they did a number of things. They gave us the most efficient, most consistent system for producing the most inexpensive protein we've ever had. But all the things that we did to make it efficient and consistent and inexpensive, they are precisely the things that take away flavor. Because what creates flavor in an animal with muscle is getting to use that muscle and getting a varied diet and, getting to exercise and drinking on its own and getting natural light and having, endogenous vitamin production within its tissues. And none of that happens to a bird that is just sitting in the same spot in a closed, dark barn, getting up only to eat and drink. And I mean, the one thing that I think is important to say is that even though this story of the transformation of chicken is a pretty dark story, there are some positives in it now, in the past couple of years. And one of them is that some chicken production is changing. Mm-hmm. It's changing in ways that it reduces antibiotic use.
And that's very, very interesting to me because, you know, on the one hand, consumers now have the perception that antibiotic-free is an added value, so that we're having greater awareness. We don't want to consume them. But it would seem to me that there has to be more of an economic impetus, that antibiotics ultimately got played out as a means of enhancing growth. Is that correct?
Right. So the reasons why, to catch up what we're talking about, to set the stage for this.
So there's been this real evolution just in the past couple of years since 2014 of very large chicken companies such as Purdue turning away from antibiotics with a couple of reasons behind it, I think. First was that they realized that they weren't getting much benefit anymore, so why should they spend the money? You know, that 10 to 15% gain that we talked about in the 1950s no longer exists because other things such as housing and nutrition and cleanliness on farms have gotten better. There also was that government regulation coming in for the first time with the Obama administration to make it much harder for producers to use growth promoters in the United States following what Europe had done more than 10 years ago. But I really think the biggest thing is that a consumer movement of healthcare systems and school systems and enlightened parents and advocates and chefs and so forth together turned away from meat raised with routine antibiotics, understanding the risks. And when they said to the companies, We just really don't want to spend our money on this anymore, the companies listened.
Yeah. I mean, and however, it's left consumers with sort of a welter of possibilities when they go to the poultry counter. And, you know, you'll see, free range, you'll see organic, these terms are sort of bandied about. Happy hens, well, that's the eggs. So, you know, what are some of the different levels and how can you kind of maneuver your way among them and obtain the cleanest product?
It's true. We do ask a lot of consumers in label raising and we have to help them, you know, be careful about what they're reading. So here's an example. So almost every package of chicken meat in the United States will say cage-free, no growth hormones. Well, broilers in the United States were never raised in cages. So that is a claim that is both true and pointless. Similarly, it's illegal to give growth promoters to chickens. So I said that wrong, sorry. Similarly, it is illegal to give growth hormones to chickens. So that's sort of a label claim that is both true and, again, not really worth very much. My ask of people is that they, when they can and when they can afford it, they buy antibiotic-free. Because antibiotic-free is actually more important than organic for certain things. In chicken, the organic standard starts on the second day of a chicken's life. So that chicken could have been injected with an antibiotic in the egg, which happens as a companion to a vaccine that's given in the egg, or it could have gotten antibiotics on the first day of its life. That could cause enough of a perturbation of the growth the gut microbiome to really start generating antibiotic resistant bacteria. So though we think of organic as the be-all and end-all, antibiotic-free has some specific other things that it can add to the mix. And I really ask people to support those producers when they can.
And what other measures are being undertaken to get U.S. producers to emulate their European colleagues who really value quality and flavor? And, you know, perhaps the food is a little more expensive, but it seems that European consumers are going big time for those values. They're not always looking for the least common denominator.
That's right. And so, I mean, of course, you have to allow for the fact that food, I think, just plays a different role
culturally.
In European society, culturally
yeah.
than
especially
it does
in
here.
France. Yeah.
But it's really fascinating to me that some of the companies that have pursued antibiotic-free aggressively, and again, Purdue is an example, have found that going antibiotic-free inevitably leads them to a reconsideration of their standards for animal welfare, such that Purdue, a year ago, put out an animal welfare plan that it made public with the assistance of animal welfare advocates, which is probably not something that they would have done before. And those standards call for things like an improved diet, so no rendering products, no protein from other slaughtered animals, no industrial discards. The birds can now get light, They're putting windows in the barns. They get exercise. There are things put on the barns to allow them to flap from and hop up on and so forth. And they may even be slightly changing the genetics of the chicken to make them a little more balanced and to allow them to live a little longer. And Purdue executives have said to me that it was the reconsideration of antibiotics that brought them to a reconsideration of animal welfare. And again, it's all those things that we now allow, we used to not allow the chickens to do, and now we may again, that will create more flavor in chicken. And that will, I hope, bring us back to what chickens more used to be like, while maintaining the efficiency and consistency of the high throughput protein production model we have. If, you know, if you can afford a pastured bird, that spent its entire life outdoors, scratching up bugs and getting sunlight on its feathers, that's fantastic. Their labor costs are really high though. So to me, that even sort of industrial scale chicken can go antibiotic free, while it's not as good as the pastured bird, it's a significant win for public health.
Well, you know, when Americans were leery of eating fish in the 1950s, they came up with a solution, which was Mrs. Paul's fish sticks, which is, you know, a way to disguise the flavor of fish, coat it with a batter and all kinds of seasonings and probably some chemicals to entice people to eat more. And, of course, the favorite food of little kids these days is
the chicken nuggets.
Chicken nuggets.
So, and the chicken nugget was invented to make people eat more chicken.
Yeah. And so as a delivery system for a chicken, how suitable is it? You know, and of course, a lot of fast foods are based around not chicken that's discernible as coming from part of a chicken, but some sort of distillation of chicken meat.
So the chicken nugget has a really fascinating history, and it goes back before McDonald's introduction of the nugget to a very little known Cornell University professor named Robert Baker, whose assignment in the 1960s was to find a way to make people buy more chicken. So this comes after the Chicken of Tomorrow contest. Yeah. They've come up with these big new breasty birds. But chicken is still just like a thing confined to the bones of the carcass. So people can only like roast it or bake it or fry it. And all of those things are things that take a while to do in the 1960s as women are entering the workforce more. Nobody wants to spend an hour cooking dinner at the end of the day. And so Baker has the idea to take chicken off the bone, and he invents so many things in his basement laboratory at Cornell that we now take for granted in supermarkets, like chicken cold cuts and chicken hot dogs. And his signature invention, modeled after the chicken, after the fish stick, was what he called the chicken stick, which we later came to know as the chicken nugget. And it was really that moment when chicken becomes what the industry calls further processed, that is made into things that are apart from the chicken carcass, that chicken starts its journey into becoming the meat that we eat more than any other in America, a meat that we literally eat, according to the poundage, every single day.
And a surprising fact that I learned from your book is that, when you think of eating chicken that's maybe tainted, you think of, developing a stomach ache, diarrhea, something akin to Montezuma's revenge. But it turns out that a lot of UTIs, urinary tract infections in women, can be traced to the bacteria that are found in chicken. Now, how does that work, that the bacteria that come from a chicken that you eat somehow find their way into the urinary tract? What's going on there?
This is such a fascinating story, and it's just one example of the way in which the resistant bacteria that are generated on farms can have these unintended consequences moving through society along paths that we don't recognize. So if you think of what usually happens with a foodborne illness, there is a pathogen that is originated in the guts of an animal, and it gets into your guts when we eat the animal product. And there's a reaction that is relatively swift. Sometimes it's only hours in the case of something like staph food poisoning. Sometimes it might be a couple of days, but the reaction, as you say, is this gastric upset that really lets us know we've eaten something bad. But an alternative to that is that the resistant bacteria are swallowed by us, and they just become part of our gut microbiome. They are there sort of quiescently. They do not cause an immediate disease reaction.
Right.
And then at some point, they get out of our guts again. And that, you know, the women who have had UTIs will understand this intuitively. You know, mm-hmm. for women, the urinary tract and the gut are not that far apart. Right. And so just the gut bacteria get introduced to the urinary tract and cause a bladder infection. And in some cases, climb up to the kidneys, which are a kind of backdoor mm-hmm. to the circulatory mm-hmm. system. Now, UTIs are so common, there are 6 to 8 million in the United States every year, that they're just treated every single time as both a one-off and only, and also as something that's very minor. So a woman who has UTI symptoms will go to her doctor. They will almost never do a culture to figure out what's going on. They'll just empirically mm-hmm. prescribe one of a standard set of antibiotics that have been recommended by the professional societies. Mm-hmm. Well, if that woman takes that course of antibiotics and then her symptoms recur, then the natural assumption has always been, oh, she just got infected again. Maybe she has a partner who is colonized. Maybe she's just sloppy. Maybe she's having too much sex. There's always this mm-hmm. sort of discussion.
Honeymoon cystitis, so-called.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah, yeah. That there's this sort of gendered assumption that it's, that women are somehow misbehaving and UTIs are the result. But sometimes what happens, it's not that it's a new, that she's been reinfected. It's that her original infection was never cured, and it wasn't cured because the antibiotics didn't work. And those are the cases that in which what is effectively an untreated infection, because it's an infection that's been treated with a drug that is not working, climb up the urinary system into the kidney, which is a backdoor to the circulatory system, move into other, you know, cause kidney infections, move into other organ systems, eventually cause septic shock.
Yeah.
There are the
E. coli number 0157 or something like that is just a devastating.
E. coli ST131, I think, is the most recent culprit. So there's a small cadre of researchers who have been trying to elucidate this process for more than 10 years now. And their estimate is that of the 6 to 8 million UTIs that occur in the United States each year, maybe 10% of them, that's 600 to 800,000 cases, might be due to foodborne antibiotic resistance. Just think of the cost in doctor's visits, in lost work time, in lost work productivity, in transit time, in multiple prescriptions. That is one of the not yet identified costs of overuse of antibiotics on farms. And we could fix that if we dialed down the antibiotic use in raising meat animals.
So bottom line for consumers, if they go to the market and they pick up, say, you know, chicken wings, chicken breasts for, you know, the weekend grilling, what are the chances that they will get products that have been exposed to antibiotics? I mean, if they're not careful and discerning.
You know, it's very hard to know. I mean, even
there's got to be some cheating. You know, there's some, you know, farmers and producers who maybe, I don't know, maybe they get the antibiotics from veterinarians. They don't no longer can purchase the antibiotics officially, but maybe, you know, they see their chickens are scrawny, they're dying, in an effort to rejigger production. Maybe they find a friendly vet, you know, who's going to give them some antibiotics.
There may be cheating. There may be cross-contamination. There even is a case on record where there were companies that thought they were doing the right thing by going antibiotic-free, but what they didn't realize was that the parents and grandparents and great-grandparents of the birds that they were raising for meat,
vertical transmission
the production pyramid,
yeah.
Those birds were given antibiotics in their lives. Oof. And drug-resistant bacteria, you know, it's already known that salmonella can pass transovarially. It can pass from a hen to her chicks.
Yeah.
So in one of those layers of the production system, which very little is known, they are very, very tightly held intellectual property, antibiotic resistance was generated and came down through the production pyramid and existed in birds that, as far as the producer was concerned, had been raised antibiotic-free. So the only answer to this, as far as I'm concerned, is that we just have to get out as many antibiotics as we can. The peril will never go away until we do. And if we can, then we will reduce the selective pressure that causes antibiotic-resistant bacteria to emerge. And that's where we need to get to, because we need to preserve the actions of our remaining antibiotics as long as we can.
Indeed. You know, it's a major international crisis. And, you know, we talk about, you know, all kinds of perils to the world environment, overpopulation, environmental pollution, global warming, but this is a crisis that can't be ignored. And it starts at the supermarket counter, you know, and we as consumers can vote with our dollars. So
that's right, three times a day with what we eat.
Indeed. So, and in addition to your book, which is excellent, it's impeccably researched, balanced, and informative. And it's a great window into understanding not just chicken, but just our overall agricultural system in this country. Additional resources that you can point people to?
So, if people want to know more about this, you know, there's a lot more information at the book's website, which is Big Chicken the Book. I myself can be found at marinmckenna.com. And I do a lot of calling out on social media of new research that I find interesting. And most of that is on Twitter. So people can find me at Marin, M-C-K, on Twitter and also on Instagram.
Marin, M-C-K. Okay.
That's
which
right.
is short for McKenna. Great. Well, hey, thanks for your great work. You're making a wonderful contribution to our understanding. And keep up the great work. Really appreciate
Thank
you
so much.
Here.
Thank you so much for having me and for this discussion.
Marin McKenna. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.